12. The new methodology. There are two ways of analyzing and interpreting each of the major developments since 1958 in world communism described in Part 2. According to the conventional view, based on the old, obsolete methodology, each of these developments is a manifestation of the spontaneous growth of fissile tendencies in international communism. The new methodology leads to the radically different conclusion that each of them forms part of an interlocking series of strategic disinformation operations designed to implement long-range bloc policy and its strategies. The essence of the new methodology, which distinguishes it from the old, is that it takes into account the new policy and the role of disinformation. Conventional methodology frequently attempts to analyze and interpret events in the communist world in isolation and on a year-to-year basis. Communist initiatives are seen as spontaneously occurring attempts to achieve short-term objectives. But because the years 1957-60 saw a readjustment in intra-bloc relations and the formulation and adoption of a new long-range policy for the bloc as a whole, a proper understanding of what occurred in those years provides the key to understanding what has happened since. The first and basic principle of the new methodology is that the starting point for the analysis of all subsequent events should be the period 1957-60. Factors underlying the new methodology. From the account of those years already given, based largely on inside information, 8 new factors can be isolated. Only if all these factors and the interaction between them are understood and taken into account together can analysis of the developments of the past 20 years yield correct results. These factors are the readjustments in relations between members of the communist bloc, including Yugoslavia, from 1957 onward and the adoption of a common long-range policy. The settlement of the question of Stalinism. The establishment of collective leadership, the ending of power struggles, and the solution of the succession problem. The phases and long-range objectives of the policy. The historical experience on which the policy was based. The preparations made to use the party apparatus, the mass organizations, and the diplomatic, intelligence, and security services of the whole bloc for purposes of political influence and strategic disinformation. The adoption of a weakness and evolution pattern of disinformation. The new appreciation by communist strategists of the use that could be made of polemics between different members of the communist bloc. From these new factors, new analytical principles can be derived. Each factor will be considered in turn. Before the new policy began to be formulated, and as one of the essential preconditions for its formulation, a new relationship between the regimes of the communist bloc was established in 1957. Soviet domination over the East European satellites and Stalinist attempts to interfere in Chinese and Yugoslav communist affairs were abandoned in favor of the Leninist concepts of equality and proletarian internationalism. Domination gave way to genuine partnership and mutual cooperation and coordination in pursuit of the common long-range interests and objectives of the whole of the communist bloc and movement. Account was taken of the diversity of the specific national conditions within which each communist regime and party was operating. Obsolete, conventional methodology failed to spot the significance of this change. It continued to see the Soviet Party as striving, often unsuccessfully and in competition with the Chinese, to exert its influence over the other communist parties so as to ensure their conformity with the Soviet pattern. Once it is realized that, by mutual agreement between the 81 parties that signed the Manifesto of November 1960, diversity within the communist movement was sanctioned, it is easy to see that arguments and disputes between communists over the orthodoxy of different tactics are artificial, contrived, and calculated to serve particular strategic or tactical ends. The new methodology starts from the premise that the 81 parties all committed themselves to the new long-range policy and agreed to contribute toward its objectives according to the nature and scale of their resources. Furthermore, since diversity was licensed, there could be a division of labor between parties and any one of them could be allotted a special strategic role in accordance with its national specifics and Lenin's suggestion. In an earlier historical context, that we need a great orchestra. We have to work out from experience how to allocate the parts, to give a sentimental violin to one, a terrible double bass to another, the conductor's baton to a third. When the decisions of 1957-60 gave the Soviet, Chinese, Albanian, Yugoslav, Romanian, Czechoslovak, Vietnamese, and other parties their different instruments and parts to play in a symphonic score, the old methodology hears only the discordant sounds. The new methodology strives to appreciate the symphony as a whole. The new interpretation of the evidence available from official communist sources leads to the identification of six interlocking communist strategies and illustrates the different strategic roles allotted to different communist parties within the overall design. The Congress of Bloc Communist Parties in 1957 agreed on a common, balanced assessment of Stalin's mistakes and crimes and on the measures needed to correct them. The basis for differences between communists on the question of Stalinism and de-Stalinization was removed. The issues were settled. The old methodology took little or no account of this and continued to see them as matters in contention between different Soviet leaders and between the Soviets and the Chinese and Albanians. The new methodology sees Stalinism from 1958 onward as a dead issue that was deliberately and artificially revived and used for the projection of a false image of warring factions among the leaders of the communist bloc. An understanding of the constituent elements of de-Stalinization and the way they were exploited provides a key to the understanding of communist tactics and technique in the rest of the program of related disinformation operations dealing with. For example, the alleged conflicts between Yugoslav and Soviet revisionism and Chinese and Albanian Stalinism, or the independence of Romania. From 1958 onward, the concept of collective leadership widened progressively to cover far more than agreement on policy between the individual members of the Presidium or Politburo. It began to embrace all those who were in a position to contribute toward the formulation of the policy and the development and application of ways and means of achieving its ends, including not only the leaders of all the bloc and some of the more important non-bloc parties, but also senior officials in the Central Committee apparatuses, the diplomatic and intelligence services, and the academies of sciences. The settlement of the issue of Stalinism, together with the establishment of collective leadership in this sense and the downward diffusion of power and influence that it entailed, effectively removed the grounds for genuine factionalism, power struggles, and succession problems in the leadership of the bloc communist parties. Thenceforward, these phenomena were available to be used as the subjects of disinformation operations in support of long-range policy, and it is in this light that the new methodology regards them. Kremlinologists and China watchers were caught out when they continued to try to rationalize the ups and downs of Soviet and Chinese leaders by using the outdated methodology, which took no account of disinformation. According to the new methodology, promotions and demotions, purges and rehabilitations, even deaths and obituary notices of prominent communist figures, formerly significant pointers for the Borkinov method of analysis, should be examined for their relevance to communist attempts to misrepresent shifts in policy as dictated by personal rather than strategic or tactical considerations. Conventional methodology tries to analyze developments in the situation and policies of the communist world either in terms of short-term objectives or in terms of the rival, long-range great power national interests of the Soviet Union and China. It seldom appreciates the marked influence, especially since 1958-60, of dialectical thinking on communist policies, which frequently entail their own opposites, communist détente diplomacy, for example, implying the calculated raising of international tension over specific issues and its subsequent relaxation when specific communist objectives have been achieved, the disgrace of communist leaders, implying their later rehabilitation, the harassment or forced exile of dissidents, implying their eventual pardon or return to their homeland. The new methodology examines current developments in relation to the objectives of the long-range policy. It sees that policy is having three phases, like its predecessor, the NEP. The first phase is the creation of favorable conditions for the implementation of the policy. The second is the exploitation of Western misunderstanding of the policy to gain specific advantages. These two phases, like the phases of an alternating current electric supply, are continuous, overlapping, and interacting. The beginning of the third and final offensive phase is marked by a major shift in communist tactics and preparation for a comprehensive assault on the West, in which the communist world, taking advantage of the West's long-term strategic errors, moves forward toward its ultimate objective of the global triumph of international communism. In the first phase of the NEP, economic reform was used both to revive the economy and to foster the illusion that Soviet Russia had lost its revolutionary impetus. Favorable conditions were thus created for the second phase, that of stabilizing the regime and winning diplomatic recognition and economic concessions from the Western powers. The third phase began with the reversal of the economic reforms in 1929 and the launching of ideological offensives internally through the nationalization of industry and the collectivization of agriculture, and externally through Common turn subversion. The success of both internal and external offensives was prejudiced by the distortions of the Stalinist regime. The corresponding first two phases of the current long-range policy have already lasted over 20 years. The final phase may be expected to begin in the early 1980s. The intermediate objectives of the policy may be summarized as follows: the political stabilization and strengthening of the individual communist regimes as an essential precondition for the strengthening of the bloc as a whole, the correction of the economic deficiencies of the bloc through international trade and the acquisition of credits and technology from the industrially advanced non-communist countries, the creation of the substructure for an eventual world federation of communist states, the isolation of the United States from its allies, and the promotion of united action with socialists in Western Europe and Japan, with a view to securing the dissolution of NATO and the United States-Japan Security Pact and an alignment between the Soviet Union and a neutral, preferably socialist, Western Europe and Japan against the United States. United action with nationalist leaders in third world countries to eliminate Western influence from those countries as a preliminary to their absorption into the communist bloc. The procurement of a decisive shift in the balance of political and military power in favor of the communist world. The ideological disarmament of the West in order to create favorable conditions for the final offensive phase of the policy and the ultimate convergence of East and West on communist terms. The new methodology aims to see how developments in the communist world may relate and contribute to the achievement of these objectives in each phase of the policy. The decisions of November 1960 authorized the use of all forms of tactics, right and left, legal and revolutionary, conventional and ideological, in pursuit of communist aims. Conformity with the Soviet pattern having ceased to be a criterion of orthodoxy, the most potent cause of actual and potential splits in the communist world had vanished. The new methodology therefore examines the so-called splits as a new form of tactic and tries to see how they serve the aims of policy. Once it is realized that licensed anti-Sovietism can in fact yield dividends for overall communist strategy, it is easy to see that the anti-Sovietism of leading dissidents inside the Soviet Union and Euro-communists outside it, like the anti-Sovietism of the Chinese, Albanian, Yugoslav, and Romanian leaders, is artificially contrived to serve the ends of long-range policy. The old methodology takes little or no account of the history of the NEP and other periods in which disinformation was important. It cannot therefore appreciate or illuminate the implementation of the long-range policy that was based largely on a re-examination of that history. The new methodology applies the lessons of the NEP, the elements in it most relevant to the 1960s, and therefore most useful to the new methodology for purposes of comparison, were the stabilization of the Soviet regime by the creation of spurious, controlled opposition movements and the effective use of those movements to neutralize genuine internal and external opposition, the creation of favorable conditions for an activist Soviet foreign policy aimed at securing diplomatic recognition by and increased trade with the Western powers, the experience of the Treaty of Rapallo, of entering into a secret political and military alliance with a capitalist state for acquiring military technology, the successful projection of a false image of the Far Eastern Republic, DVR, as an independent regime, Lenin's tactical advice to communist parties on overcoming their isolation, establishing united fronts with socialists, and increasing their influence in parliaments and trade unions. The genuine Tito-Stalin split in 1948 provided the communist strategists 10 years later with a model on which to base their planning of spurious splits in the future. The history of Soviet-Yugoslav relations from 1948 to 1955 therefore provides the new methodology with a set of criteria for judging the authenticity of subsequent splits. The decision to use the intelligence potential of the bloc for strategic disinformation purposes, embodied in the Shelepin Report in 1959 and related documents, destroys the notion, implicit in much of conventional methodology, that the communist intelligence services are engaged solely in espionage and security work. The new methodology takes into account the Shelepin Report and the important role allocated to Soviet officials, trade unionists, scientists, priests, academics, artists, and other intellectuals in the implementation of policy through the exercise of political influence. The new methodology tries to see how their activities and public statements may serve the interests of policy, to create favorable conditions for the implementation of that policy. The bloc strategists adopted the weakness and evolution pattern of disinformation used successfully in the NEP period in the Soviet Union and extended since 1958-60 to cover the whole communist bloc. The new methodology therefore dictates that all information reaching the West on the communist world and the international communist movement, including Eurocommunism, should be assessed in relation to that pattern. A significant contribution to the formulation of the long-range policy and disinformation technique about splits was made by the Yugoslav leader Edvard Kardelj, whose book Socialism and War was published shortly before the 81 Party Congress in November 1960. In it, Kardelj wrote that differences of opinion between communists are not only not harmful but are the law of progress. 3. According to Kardelj, the domestic and foreign policies of the Yugoslav Communist Party could not be independent of the interests of socialism, but could be independent of the subjectively concocted notions for of other parties, such as the CPC. One should not be content with interpreting this or that phenomenon in the course of development by the simple repetition of stereotyped dogmatic phrases. 5. When making an objective analysis, one should try to separate what is subjective from what is objective, that is, not allow slogans or political declarations to conceal insight into the real substance of things. 6. Tito made much the same Leninist point when he said in 1958 that internationalism is practice, not words and propaganda. 7. For obvious reasons, Kardelj and Tito could not openly announce that spurious polemics between communist parties were thenceforward to be used as part of the technique of communist disinformation. Nevertheless, the distinction clearly drawn between the subjective nature of polemics and the objective nature of common interests and socialist solidarity expressed in unity of actions provided a theoretical basis on which the genuine polemics between Tito and Stalin could be transmuted, when required by the interests of long-range policy, into spurious polemics between communist leaders without endangering the fundamental ideological and practical unity of the communist world. An up-to-date restatement of Kardelj's point has been made by Yuri Krasin. Complete unanimity can hardly be a precondition of joint action. What is needed is not static, monolithic unity, but a dynamic system of views and positions marked by differences on particular issues, but developing on the basis of the fundamental principles of Marxism-Leninism common to all. From such statements and their implications, 5 related principles can be derived. The first is not to assume that where there are polemics between communists, there are necessarily divisions. The second is to assess whether or not there are any solid and consistent grounds for the existence of disputes. The third is to seek evidence of unity of actions behind the disunity of words, to look for secretly coordinated joint actions by apparent enemies or rivals. The fourth is to seek correlations in timing between outbursts of polemics and major communist initiatives or negotiations with Western powers, SALT, for instance, or meetings with Western leaders. The fifth is to assume that polemics form part of a disinformation operation and examine them to see if, regarded in that light, they could contribute toward the achievement of communist objectives. To take some obvious examples, Khrushchev's charges of Chinese warmongering and Chinese countercharges of Soviet revisionism and pacificism in the 1960s should be examined to see if they helped to build up Khrushchev's image in the West as a moderate with whom it was possible to negotiate concrete deals. Yugoslavia's continued exclusion from the communist bloc, despite Tito's secret participation in the formulation and execution of the new long-range policy, should be considered in relation to the buildup of Yugoslavia's credibility as a leader of the non-aligned movement in the Third World. Soviet attacks on conservative Western leaders in the last few years should be viewed in conjunction with Chinese efforts to cultivate closer relations with those same leaders. The escalation of Sino-Soviet hostilities in 1969-70 should be considered as intended to facilitate both the SALT talks between the Soviet Union and the United States and Chinese rapprochement with the advanced industrial nations. In short, the study of polemics, if they are read as disinformation, may throw light not on the existence of splits, but on the long-range policy and strategic interests that apparent splits are intended to promote. The new methodology and Western sources. The existence of a program of disinformation operations has implications for every type of source of information on the communist world. Continued failure to take disinformation into account will lead to the continuing proliferation of errors in Western assessments of, and policy toward, the communist world. Given the communist concept of total disinformation, any Western reassessment of the situation, if it is to have meaning, should cover information from all sources, open and secret, human and technical. The assumption that if secret and open sources in general support one another, the reliability of both is confirmed should be dropped. It should be realized that the two streams of information, open and secret, may well have a common point of origin in the central committees and disinformation departments of the bloc parties and intelligence services. If information from Western secret sources is in line with information from open sources, including official communist sources, that alone calls the reliability of the Western secret sources into question. Those Western secret sources whose information since 1958-60 conforms with the weakness and evolution pattern need particularly careful scrutiny to see whether they have become known to the communist side through compromise or other means. If conformity with the normal pattern of information coming from the communist world is an indication of the unreliability of sources, the converse principle is that greater weight should be given to evidence that conflicts with that pattern, even if it comes only from a single source. For example, the personal observations of a Western visitor to a Chinese commune in 1961, who reported that commune dwellers were no worse off in material terms than they were before, and that the Chinese people were inevitably becoming more closely identified with the communist regime, should not have been discounted on the grounds that the observations conflicted with the generally accepted opinion of the time that the situation in the communes was disastrous. 9. Total disinformation, to be effective, necessitates the release by the communist side of a volume of accurate information about itself, including genuine secrets, in order to give credibility and weight to the disinformation it is seeking to convey. In the Stalin period, the release of secret information by the communist side was impossible. With the adoption of the long-range policy and disinformation program, the position changed. The Leninist concept of primary and secondary types of sacrifice was reintroduced. The primary communist secret is the existence and nature of the long-range bloc policy and strategy and the role of disinformation. Military, scientific and technical, economic, and counter-espionage secrets are secondary. They form a reservoir from which information may be drawn and given away for strategic purposes, particularly if there is some reason to think that it may already have been compromised by genuine leakages or technical means. For example, the identities of secret agents who for one reason or another are reaching the end of their usefulness to the communist side may be given away through a source in whom the communist side is seeking to establish Western confidence. The good faith of Western secret sources or of defectors from the communist side is not therefore automatically established by the fact that they produce quantities of information on military, economic, scientific, and technical, or counter-espionage subjects, or that they give vent to spectacular denunciations of communism. A more important criterion is what they have to say on communist long-range policy and the use of disinformation. The number of communist leaders, officials, and intellectuals who have full knowledge of the scope and scale of the disinformation program is very limited, but the number who participate in one or other of its aspects is very large. Most secret sources or defectors, if they have genuinely transferred their allegiance to the West, should have something of value to say on current communist techniques in this field, even if they themselves do not realize the full significance of their own knowledge. In evaluating scientific and technical information reaching the West, due regard should be paid to the fact that Shelepin, in his May 1959 report and articles for KGB staff and Chekist, called for the preparation of disinformation operations designed to confuse and disorientate Western scientific, technological, and military programs, to bring about changes in Western priorities, and to involve the West in costly, wasteful, and ineffective lines of research and development. It is to be expected, therefore, that information available in the West on Soviet space projects, weapon systems, military statistics, and developments in science and technology will be found to contain an element of disinformation. Given that a program of total disinformation is in operation and given that the communist side is well aware of Western interest in intercepting its communications, evidence derived from communist communications in plain language or weak codes and ciphers is particularly suspect. In fact, it should be treated in the same way as evidence from official communist sources. According to the Western press, some at least of the evidence on casualties in the Sino-Vietnamese War in 1979 fell into this category. The new methodology in communist sources. All communist sources are permanently available for use as channels for disinformation. All must conform to the current pattern if the credibility of the pattern is to be maintained. Nevertheless, it is possible to distinguish between sources that are more or less likely to be used for conveying disinformation to the West and those that are more or less likely to contain revealing information on the implementation of the long-range policy. Official Communist Sources. Beginning with the official statements and decisions of international communist gatherings, those in the period 1957 to 1960 are of fundamental importance. Not only because that was the period of the formulation and adoption of the long-range policy, but also because of the nature of the policy itself. An essential element in it was that its existence and modus operandi should not be appreciated in the West. It was to be expected, therefore, that once it had been adopted, subsequent official policy statements should have been less revealing about long-range objectives and the methods of achieving them than the fundamental documents of the period of policy formation. The latter should be considered as including the documents of the Congress of Bloc Communist Parties in 1957, the 21st CPSU Congress in January-February 1959, the Congress of 81 Communist Parties in November 1960, and Khrushchev's Strategic Report of January 6, 1961, basing themselves largely on retrospective evidence about disagreements at the 81-party Congress. Most Western analysts concluded that the decisions of that Congress represented a compromise between the positions of the various conflicting communist parties that signed the Congress Manifesto with varying degrees of reluctance or commitment to abide by the Congress's decisions. The conclusion was incorrect. The Congress lasted several weeks. No doubt many different parties aired many different views, as they had every right to do, according to Leninist principles of democratic centralism, before the policy had been adopted. Once the discussions had concluded and the policy had been ratified by the majority decision, all parties which signed the manifesto undertook a serious commitment to work for the implementation of the policy. Any party that had genuinely dissented from the Congress's decisions would not have signed the manifesto and would have been ostracized by the international communist movement. Any party wishing to maintain its standing in the movement must be able to demonstrate that it has made consistent efforts to put the decisions of the Congress into effect. If communist parties in general did not take the decisions of the higher organs of authority seriously and strive consistently to implement them, they would not be the disciplined and effective bodies they are known to be. The element of political determinism should not be overlooked, considering that it has been revealed daily in the statements and actions of communist parties inside and outside the bloc, in the proceedings of their national party congresses during the past 20 years, and in their implementation of the policy and its concomitant strategies. In accepting the evidence that the 81-party Congress signified a watershed in the disunity of the communist world rather than the opposite, Western analysts, unaware of the disinformation program, made a fundamental error on which it was easy for the communist strategists to build in the development of their major strategies in Europe, the Third World, and the military and ideological fields. Largely because of this error, later evidence and official communist sources on communist disunity came to be almost automatically accepted in the West at its face value. Given that the disinformation program is directed primarily, though not exclusively, at the non-communist world, it is imperative to distinguish those communist speeches, publications, and broadcasts that are primarily intended for communist audiences from those that are primarily intended for non-communist audiences. Obviously, the second category is likely to contain more disinformation than the first. It is not possible wholly to conceal the policy and its implementation from those who are expected to carry it out. For that reason, the basic decisions of the period 1958 to 1960 were published, as were the findings of the Congress of Communist Parties in 1969, which reviewed progress in the first decade of the policy. To a greater extent than elsewhere, progress in the coordination and consolidation of the communist bloc, particularly through Comecon and the Warsaw Pact Organization, is recorded in the annual supplements of the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, which are available only in Russian. Naturally, they do not disclose the nature of the disinformation program. Nevertheless, items are occasionally included that figure less prominently, if at all, in publications directed at the West and that call into question the depth and authenticity of splits and crises in the bloc. In particular, the encyclopedia reflects the continual exchange of visits of communist leaders and delegations between communist countries and parties that are supposed to be at odds with one another. Sometimes these meetings are publicized elsewhere in the communist press, accompanied by photographs of, for example, Brezhnev warmly embracing Dubček, Tito, or Ceausescu. Western commentators, in their obsession with splits in the communist world, automatically assume that such meetings are held in attempts, usually unsuccessful, to resolve the differences between the parties and that the photographs are intended to mask the hostility between the leaders. They forget that in the years of the genuine Tito-Stalin split, it would have been more than Tito's life was worth to have visited Moscow. And they overlook the possibility that the meetings in the 1960s and 1970s have been taking place in order to coordinate the display of bogus differences intended to serve the interests of long-range policy. The Western scholars who devoted so much attention to esoteric evidence and the communist sources pointing to splits between the Soviet Union and China and Albania seldom seem to realize that only a privileged few in the communist world, and mainly those concerned with policy and the disinformation program, were in a position to make detailed comparisons between the press of their own party and the press of other parties. Even if foreign newspapers or broadcasts were available, few Russians could read or understand Chinese or Albanian, and not many Albanians or Chinese could read or understand Russian. Radio Moscow broadcasts in Albanian in 1960-61 may not have been audible in Albania unless retransmitted by an Albanian station. They were, however, picked up by the BBC and other interested Western organizations and circulated to Western analysts in summaries of world broadcasts and similar publications. The Communist intelligence services were well aware of this, but few Western analysts spotted that some of the polemics between communist leaders may only have reached a Western audience. In their preoccupation with finding and examining splits in the communist world, Western analysts focused all their attention on the passages in communist speeches and articles that betrayed differences in approach between different parties or different leaders. Passages dealing, for example, with communist unity and commitment to the decisions of the 81 Party Congress were ignored or written off as lip service to communist shibboleths. This is not necessarily the way in which they were read and understood by members of the communist parties concerned. Because Western analysts have not been sufficiently on the lookout for disinformation, they have paid inadequate attention to the origin and authenticity of the text of important communist statements and speeches, particularly in cases where more than one text has been available. Even where disputes in the communist world are reflected in official communist publications available to the West, the perception of them by the party membership in the countries concerned is likely to be very different from the perception of them in the West. By using various devices such as those suggested above, the party leadership is in a position to project simultaneously two different images of the same dispute. To the West, it may seem to be of profound significance. In the East, it may well be a little local difficulty whose consequences for the leaders of the parties concerned may be wholly beneficial. To take a concrete example, as far as the author was aware, no information or guidance was issued to CPSU members on the Soviet-Albanian dispute before the 22nd CPSU Congress in October 1961, when Khrushchev publicly attacked the Albanian leaders. The only knowledge that the author had of anything unusual in Soviet-Albanian relations up to that point was derived from statements by two senior colleagues in the KGB in 1959 that a disinformation operation on Soviet Yugoslav and Soviet-Albanian relations had been planned during 1958-59. Unofficial communist sources. It is not uncommon for disclosures in the communist press about dissension in the communist world to be backed up by off-the-record remarks by communist leaders and officials to their Western counterparts and friends. Bearing in mind that the KGB and the other communist security services together can count the total numbers of their informers as literally in the millions, it is a relatively simple matter for them to control the few thousands of their citizens who are in any regular form of official or semi-official contact with foreigners. Communist regimes are not tolerant of disclosures of information by their servants to foreigners. As Khrushchev himself put it, in repudiating the idea that he had spoken out of turn to the late Senator Hubert Humphrey in 1958 on the subject of Chinese communes, "The mere suggestion that I might have confidential contact with a man who boasts of having spent 20 years fighting communism can only give rise to laughter. Anyone who understands anything at all about politics, to say nothing of Marxism-Leninism, will realize that a confidential talk with Mr. Humphrey about the policies of communist parties and relations with our best friends, the leaders of the Communist Party of China, is inconceivable. Yet many Western observers and scholars claim to have benefited from such disclosures." In the preface to his book The Soviet Bloc, Unity and Conflict, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote, "I am also grateful to several officials of various communist states for their willingness to discuss matters they should not have discussed with me. No explanation is offered in the book of the reasons why communist officials should have been willing to speak frankly to a prominent anti-communist scholar and citizen of the leading imperialist power. Nor is any reference made in the book to the possibilities of disinformation. But if the existence of a disinformation program is taken into account, together with the controls over the communist officials in contact with foreigners, the explanation for these indiscretions is obvious. Almost all the Western commentators on the Prague Spring of 1968 and Eurocommunism in the 1970s have shown a similar tendency to believe what they have been told by leading communist participants in the events and debates concerned. Against the background of the methods of provocation used during the NEP period and the known facts of the intensified political use of scientists, writers, and other intellectuals by the KGB from 1959 onward, the authenticity of the form of underground literature known as Samizdat, which made its appearance in the Soviet Union in the 1960s, must be regarded with skepticism. Its significance cannot be fully assessed unless the extent of its circulation inside the Soviet Union is known. There is no justification for assuming that because it reaches a fairly wide audience abroad, it is also widely read at home. It may be, in fact, that few in the Soviet Union see it other than those authorized by the KGB to do so. In short, it should be regarded as falling within the category of unofficial communist sources. Similar considerations apply to the Chinese wall posters from which the West derived much of its knowledge of the Cultural Revolution, of power struggles in the Chinese leadership, and of the Chinese attitude to the Soviet Union, especially in 1966-70. What can be said with certainty is that wall posters would not have appeared at all in this period unless the Chinese leadership had wished them to do so, and that the Chinese authorities were well aware of the attention paid to them by non-communist diplomats, journalists, and other foreign representatives in China. This alone provides grounds for reconsidering their contents against the current pattern of communist disinformation. Their full significance cannot be judged without knowing precisely by whom they were put up and what guidance was given to party members about them through the normal channels of party communication. Secret communist sources. The remaining category of communist sources is the leakage or disclosure, documentary or otherwise, of information on the proceedings of secret party meetings and international conferences. A conspicuous feature of the evidence on disagreements between parties at the Romanian Communist Party Congress in June 1960 and at the Communist 81 Party Congress later in the same year is that most of it was retrospective and much of it reached the West with some delay. This is a significant factor, given the existence of a disinformation program. It is a difficult matter to stage a whole conference for disinformation purposes, but it is a simple operation to fabricate or distort the record at leisure after the conference is over and to choose appropriate channels to transmit it to the West. To sum up, the new methodology provides explanations for many contradictions and anomalies in the communist world on which the old methodology throws no light. It explains the confidence of the communist world in the loyalty and dedication of the vast majority of its officials. It explains the reasons for disclosures of information by the communist world about itself and relates them to the requirements of long-range policy. It explains the seeming tolerance of a totalitarian system toward dissension openly expressed by its citizens in their contacts with foreigners. It provides criteria for assessing the reliability of sources, for distinguishing genuine secret agents and defectors from provocateurs, for distinguishing genuine information from disinformation and propaganda. It provides pointers to the identification of agents of influence in the West. It suggests that disinformation, recognized as such, can provide clues to the intentions of its authors. It offers guidance on the relative importance of the official and unofficial communist sources. It diverts attention from spectacular communist polemics between parties and focuses it instead on the solid advances in the groundwork of communist cooperation and coordination. It points the way to recovery from the crisis in Western studies and assessments of communism. It could help to revive the effectiveness of Western security and intelligence services. It explains the communist victory in the Vietnam War despite the Sino-Soviet split. Above all, it explains the willingness and ability of the communist world, despite the appearance of disunity, to seize the initiative and to develop and execute its strategies in relation to the United States, the other advanced industrial countries, and the Third World in the quest for the complete and final victory of international communism. So far, the new methodology is the methodology of a minority of one. Only time will show whether it will survive, whether it will stimulate new lines of research, whether it will replace the old, obsolete methodology, and whether it will help the West to see in a new light the real meaning and dimensions of the communist problem.